We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting with our elections, our local elections that just occurred.
Yes, astonishingly enough, the era of Greg Nickels has come to an end, although he will still be in office, of course, until January. But he becomes the second mayor in a decade in Seattle not to make it through until the general election. And I think there were a number of reasons why Nickels didn't survive the primary. The most obvious, of course, is the people who would ordinarily vote for Nickels wrote in Satan instead. But there were some other reasons also. And, you know, some of the reasons that are being attributed to it, like the, you know, his handling of the snowstorm last December, I just don't think are as significant a factor as they're being made out to be. The aspect of the snowstorm that I think did stick with people was not so much the lack of services for several days in places like Capitol Hill and North Seattle, because everybody understands that was an unusual snowstorm. It, you know, doesn't happen that Seattle gets that kind of snow very often. But what happened was Nickels coming on afterwards and giving the city a B for its efforts when so many people understood that, the city actually wasn't prepared for a disaster of that magnitude. It really underscored that Nickels in his 8 years had become somewhat arrogant and somewhat out of touch with how ordinary Seattleites, perceived the city and dealt with the city. And that manifested in several other ways as well in terms of neighborhood development versus the money that flowed into downtown development and all of the changes of character that have happened in the last 8 years in a number of different neighborhoods around Seattle. And, you know, there is a reality in which people just get tired of a mayor after a couple of terms, that they feel like it's time for new blood, it's time for a change.
Well, too, one of the stories that we had on our list of least hyped and least covered stories of the year last year was Washington State doing an audit of customer service responsiveness of local governments in the state of Washington, and that the city of Seattle ranked at the bottom of that list. That when Washington State auditors, you know, sent customer service requests to different city departments, they were given the runaround routinely and told that, well, we can't help you. You have to file your paperwork with another department, but never told which department could help them, you know. And, I mean, this is indicative of the way city residents have been treated by the city of Seattle, and they're laying that directly at – you can only lay that directly at the feet of the mayor. It's the mayor who's responsible for how the city departments respond to customer service requests. And Nickels has been supremely arrogant when it comes to making changes. He had no response to that audit. You know, he made no changes within the city of Seattle in response to that audit. He made no changes at the Department of Transportation after the snowstorm, when the city council said, let's look at what the problem is. It was really the city council that tried to make changes, and the mayor had essentially did nothing and did not come down on Grace Krennican, the Seattle Department of the head of the Department of Transportation. And, he really had nothing to say and nothing to do about it.
And I think from a political standpoint, that underscores also that Greg Nickels never really had a single constituency. He got into office in 2001, in large part on an anti-Mark Sidran vote. He courted environmentalists. Well, in this election, the environmental community pretty much was spoken to by Mike McGinn. He ran on, we're going to fix potholes and we're going to have good city services, and Joe Malahan hammered that those services, as the audit demonstrated, were not in fact being run very well. He pushed through the tunnel in face of the opposition of the voters of Seattle and Jan Drago, who also did not do very well, hammered on that routine. And so all of his constituents, natural constituencies, one by one were stripped away. He was very friendly to the neighborhoods in 2001, and they've long since abandoned him for various obvious reasons. And for that reason, you know, when push came to shove, he didn't have quite enough left, even as an incumbent with a tremendous tremendous resources and a huge war chest, and ubiquitous robocalls in the last week, you know, did not have enough left in, to get through the primary.
I think most of all, you know, I mean, this is a year when people are thinking about their own personal pocketbooks because of the economy. They're also looking at government budgets, too. And Nichols has not proven himself as somebody who can really handle the city budget very well. I mean, he's made a number of missteps, including giving an unearned bonus to the head of City Light just recently, pushing for you know, the city being responsible for open-ended cost overruns for the tunnel, and then continuing to support the Mercer Beautification Project and development of South Lake Union, you know, using a lot of city money, and at the same time telling city employees that they have to now vote on whether or not they want to take an unpaid furlough, you know, and announcing major layoffs at the city of Seattle, and pushing for things like upgrading computers that could wait, you know.
And you know what's coming up that I think a lot of people are aware of and nobody's commenting on and blaming this on the city is the week-long closure of the libraries coming
up
in a week.
Uh-huh.
That's going to affect a lot of people.
So these are things,
a lot of people are asking why the city has to do this, and they're still pushing through Mercer Street in the tunnel.
Yeah, why are they still spending, you know, huge amounts of money on these capital improvement projects when the city budget itself is suffering and basic city services are not getting taken care of? And they're laying that directly at the feet of Greg Nichols, and he is responsible for that.
All right. Other things out of the elections?
Yeah, there were several. The race for King County Executive has certainly been interesting as well, where even though local media has been really very hesitant to call out Susan Hutchison on her fanatic far-right views and the fact that she's a Republican in a theoretically nonpartisan race, she won, of course, with only some 33% of the vote. And as the votes have continued to be counted this week, the margin between her and second place Dow Constantine has narrowed to 6 points. It's now 33-27. That's going to give Constantine a real shot at winning come November, because the third, fourth, and fifth place finishers were all liberal Democrats or moderate Democrats, where you would expect most of their votes would go to Constantine in the final. So, you know, you would have to consider Constantine the favorite come November, but what we've learned as the week has gone on is that various Republican donors throughout this county and state, and even outside the state, are lining up to try and give Hutchison a huge war chest. And if the primary was any guide, the local media, and of course Hutchison was a media figure herself for a couple of decades in this city, are not going to call her on it. Nonetheless, somehow the word that Hutchison is a far-right loony managed to get out, because the gatekeepers are no longer very effective gatekeepers in terms of our local media. But one of the other things that we've learned from the primary, however, is that money can make a huge difference. And we saw that with the Bagfee losing, when the American Chemical Council spent, what, about $60 billion per vote in order to defeat the Bagfee. And I think there was a fundamental misstep there, in that rather than being fair about it and trying to give people the option of paying money to continue to use the bags, they should have just banned them outright. Because when they didn't ban them outright, it opened them to the charge that this is a new tax. And rather than simply being an up and down on the bags, where the American Chemistry Council would have had to make the case that these are in fact not toxic waste of resources and landfill hogs, they managed to make the election about a new tax in a hard economic time. And that was a very, very hard thing with all that money to battle.
Yeah.
So we could see it coming back as a ban.
As an actual ban.
Which a lot of cities are doing right now. Right.
Similar to what Edmonds passed.
Even as we waited a number of months to vote on this, other cities have moved forward and have banned these bags, notably San Francisco and Washington, D.C.
All right. Anything else on the elections?
Let's move on.
Okay. How about Jim McDermott has a proposal?
Yeah, he has once again announced a bill to remove four dams on the Lower Snake River. This is the fifth time that he's introduced a similar bill in the legislature, or has announced that he's going to introduce a similar bill in the legislature. No other major local Democrats have signed on to the bill, including Patty Murray, Maria Cantwell, or Norm Dix, whose support would be essential, I think, for the bill to pass. But this is the first time that his bill comes when we may see the federal government making a move on dam removal. Obama is due to submit a plan for protecting Snake River salmon to U.S. District Judge James Redden by September 15th. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke, who used to be governor of the state of Washington, he's in charge of making changes to the Bush administration's proposal on behalf of the Obama administration. So far, the Bush administration proposal doesn't include any kind of dam breaching, but U.S. District Court Judge James Redden has indicated that any plan to protect salmon in the Snake River will potentially have to include some kind of plan for removing dams. And former Governor Gary Locke, now Commerce Secretary Locke, may have to take a look at Jim McDermott's bill and add some of it into the new proposal by the Obama administration.
It's worth noting that Locke opposed dam removal when he was governor of Washington. And this, to me, I mean, I am so ambivalent about Jim McDermott, because he is often on the right side of an issue, or at least the side that I agree with, which, you know, by definition is the right side. he, even after 20 years in Capitol Hill, he has so little standing in his own party and gets so little for his seniority on Capitol Hill that he can't recruit allies to bills like this, and he winds up introducing bills that sound great, or rhetoric that sounds great, but it never becomes law. And you just have to contrast him with Jay Inslee, his neighbor to the north in District 1, who is not as rhetorically inflammatory, but is almost as liberal and gets a lot of stuff accomplished. It's a very stark contrast, and makes you wonder what somebody in a safe seat in Seattle, who doesn't have to worry about getting reelected and who had McDermott's politics but was a little savvier about making allies, what that kind of person could accomplish.
All right. That takes us on then to national news and the healthcare forums.
Yeah. This week, the big news on the healthcare forums were that these right-wing wackos were showing up with guns at the forums where President Obama was speaking, some of them with signs and or wearing T-shirts that were very inflammatory, indicating that, you know, it's time to water the Tree of Liberty, which refers to a Thomas Jefferson quote that from time to time, the Tree of Liberty should be watered with the blood of tyrants and so forth. So, if it were a Republican president in the Oval Office right now, the Secret Service would be taking that to mean a threat to the president's life and would be throwing these people in jail. But no, not when there's a Democrat and a man of color in the Oval Office.
And you have people actually bringing rallies to personal appearances by the, or guns rather,
guns,
personal
yes,
appearances
yes.
by the president, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, and what really gets me is that the Democrats are not condemning this. They're not saying, look, this is a form of intimidation. You know, the principle of democracy and free speech means that folks should be able to come to a political forum and not feel intimidated by someone standing near them or sitting near them with an AK-47, you know, not an AK-47, but a semi-automatic weapon on his back. This is just kind of
Who is shouting them down anytime they try to voice their opinion?
Yes, and I, you know,
these are brown shirt tactics.
Yeah,
in the rise of the Reich in the 1930s.
They are militia tactics, and they also they send a bad message to the rest of the world too, where the U.S. is supposedly trying to support elections over civil war in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, to have these forums where people show up with weapons, waving weapons around. I think that's just
insane. Shouting, get the government out of my Medicare.
yeah. And the Democrats really need to come forward and condemn this and say, this is BS, we can't have this. Sure, you have a right to have a weapon in some of these states and to have them in a public place where it is visible. However, in a political forum, you should not be doing this. It's just, it's intimidation. It is not free. It's not political speech.
Right.
And, as in other news regarding the healthcare forums and so forth, I think the Democrats really need to understand when Congress reconvenes that, the American people elected the Democrats because they're not the Republicans. We had 8 years of the Bush administration and Republicans in Congress that led us into two wars, surveillance on a massive scale in this country. Setting up secret prisons where detainees could be held indefinitely, torture, assassination.
So far, everything you've mentioned is stuff the Obama administration's continuing to do.
Yes, and it's time for the Democrats to say, we're not the Republicans and that's why you elected us, to understand that and to say that and to follow up with real action. And that includes, not reaching out to the Republicans and making concessions to them in Congress. That includes stepping up and saying, okay, it's time to pass some of the bills that we promised when we campaigned. That includes health care reform and health care reform bills without the Republican vote.
A couple of very interesting things happened this week when word leaked out last weekend that the Obama administration was continuing backing down on the public option and not including it in
right.
the bill. One of them was that the Republican leadership immediately came out and said, well, the co-op idea is unacceptable too, which tells you they're moving the goalposts and they're going to be united in opposition to anything the Obama administration opposes on health care,
right.
on general principle, and the Democrats really just need to use their own votes to get something passed and screw the Republicans because they're simply not going to cooperate on anything. Bipartisanship has been tried and it has not worked.
You made a good faith effort. Great. Now it's time to move on.
Beyond that, it's been very interesting to see that the White House seemed actually genuinely surprised at the enormous backlash that this generated among the progressive base that elected Obama in the first place, that were up in arms that the White House was reportedly abandoning the public option, and they had to walk it back. They had to come out and say in the next couple, 3 days, no, these reports were not accurate, yada, 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 because so many people were angry about it, and because the Republicans clearly, they weren't going to get any points for that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the FDIC shut down Guaranty Bank of Texas. That's the second biggest bank failure this year, and it comes just a week after the biggest bank failure of this year, which was Colonial Bank, was shut down last week by the FDIC. That brings to 81 the number of banks that were closed this year versus 25 last year and 3 that closed in 2007. I think most disturbing is that Guaranty and Colonial both were felled not by subprime mortgages or other exotic mortgages, but mostly because their regular prime mortgages have been defaulting at a high rate, and other kinds of consumer and commercial loans have been defaulting at a high rate. And this really
points... Now, what's the implication of that, just so folks aren't familiar with it?
I'm just going to say it points to a recessionary spiral, because what's happening is not just these bad loans, that banks wrote a lot of bad loans, and so the banking industry is suffering. It means that because businesses are laying people off, people can't pay their regular mortgages. People who have good credit can't pay their regular mortgages, and now that's leading to more bank troubles, which are going to be leading to more layoffs, which means more mortgage problems, et cetera, et cetera. It's pointing to a recessionary spiral. This comes in a week when Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, said, I think the economy is stabilizing now. Well, they're looking at these little economic indicators. They're not looking structurally at the system. Structurally, everything is not looking so great, as the Fed is saying.
Or they're asking their friends at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, exactly. And, those guys look at what stock to buy, what stock is cheap, et cetera, et cetera. They're not looking necessarily at these broad structural issues. I mean, this is why economists who do look at these broad structural indicators are saying, if we do pull out of the recession sometime soon, it's going to be a long, slow recovery. And some of us are looking at it saying, I don't see a long, slow recovery yet. We haven't turned the corner yet.
But they keep telling us that we're very close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many corners that we keep turning. It's the oddest thing.
Yeah. So we keep turning corners and running into more problems.
And finding ourselves in the same place.
recessionary spiral, is that it?
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Blast from the past, words from Tom Ridge.
Yes, Ridge came out this week with excerpts from a new book in which he claims that the hold on to your seats now. This is going to come pretty astonishing news to anybody who's been listening to this show for a few years, that he was under great pressure to manipulate the color codes of the terror alerts for political advantage at the Bush White House. Now, the incident that he wrote about was just before the election, when Rumsfeld and Ashcroft wanted him to raise the terror alert for the benefit of the Bush administration, and he said no. What Ridge did not write about in his book was the numerous other incidents at key times, particularly just when John Kerry got a spike in his ratings after the Democratic National Convention in 2004, when the Bush administration magically raised the terror alert level and Ridge went along with it. But this, again, is no surprise to anybody, and you didn't need inside information at the White House to figure it out. All you had to do was look at times when the Bush administration needed a distraction or needed a political boost, and times when the terror alert went up magically seemed to track remarkably closely to one another. And, you know, if one or two times, well, that's a coincidence, but 8, 9, 10 times, you start to see a pattern, and the Bush administration was about nothing if not patterns.
I think one of the interesting things, too, was in his book, he says that he was never invited to sit on National Security Council meetings. I found that very funny. It really points to the fact that Tom Ridge and the whole department of his whole position as head of Homeland Security, he really was a figurehead, and he was there for political reasons and there for the Bush administration to use to manipulate public opinion.
Yeah, and he also talked about the FBI withholding critical information from him and
so
from the DHS.
The Bush administration never took him seriously, never took the Department of Homeland Security seriously, and if they had taken the whole idea of Homeland Security itself seriously, we never would have had 9-1-1. We never would have had the 9/11 attacks.
All right, moving on. Independent media reports this week about Blackwater.
Yeah, while we're on the Bush administration, our old friend Eric Prince, the CEO of then Blackwater, now XE, and God knows how that's pronounced. But this is a man who's been credibly accused of murder and of racism and talking about Iraqis and people in the Middle East as ragheads and various other things we can't say on the radio. This is a man who is contracted to, according to reports this week, by the CIA for assassinations of key Iraqi leaders and figures during the war in Iraq. This is something that the CIA traditionally has not done. They certainly do trade in assassinations. We've known this all along. But outsourcing that to a private contractor where there's even less accountability than actually occurs within the CIA, that's astonishing. And outsourcing it to a company that has a culture of racially based hatred is very, very disturbing. And of course, we've heard of a number of incidents and allegations of Blackwater mistreating and murdering Iraqi civilians. This is another piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, it's just more of the outrageous stuff that's leaking out post Bush administration that we didn't know about, that was secret, that kind of confirms that when you elect a Republican president that's the caliber of George Bush with an assistant like Dick Cheney, this is what you get, essentially.
All right, that moves us on then to international and Afghanistan.
Yeah, fortunately, we're not handling the same way in Afghanistan, doing the same with things in Afghanistan that we were doing in Iraq. In Afghanistan, they're having elections that are marred by violence, where the United States is immediately proclaiming the election a success, even though they don't know, you know, yet how many people voted. And we've turned a corner.
Yeah, they think the turnout has been, from what I can tell so far, they think the turnout has been anywhere from about half what it was in the last Afghan election to even less than that in some districts.
Yeah, 30% is what they're talking. Now, it's been particularly notable because the turnout was especially depressed in the southern provinces where the Taliban has great control. And this gives enormous advantages to non-Pashtun candidates, Pashtun being the dominant ethnic group in Afghanistan, but they're concentrated in the south, and you have a number of different minorities that control different parts of the north.
Karzai's constituency is primarily Pashtun.
That is correct. And what happens is that when the Pashtuns don't vote and other ethnic groups get into power, that motivates the Pashtuns once more to rebel against the central government, which plays very much to the advantage of the Taliban. And this is something that the United States media is not talking about, what the implications of those depressed turnouts are for who holds office in Afghanistan and how they are received and their perceived legitimacy by the majority ethnic group there.
Yeah, at the same time, the Western media likes to say, well, the Taliban has been threatening people not to show up at polls, but turnout has been dismal in places where the security is very good in Afghanistan, and that's largely because people in the provinces feel that the central government in Kabul hasn't been responsive to them. The central government is corrupt. It's allied with opium dealers.
Yeah.
And the local government in a lot of these provinces runs on bribes and favoritism. So there are a lot of people who are very disenchanted with Karzai and the government of Afghanistan. And so that's led to a low turnout, even in areas where there's great security in the country.
All right. And finally, I see in your future Mercury playing a part.
Yes, a federal government study that looked at the levels of mercury in fish in 291 rivers and streams throughout the country found that in all the samples taken, that's all the samples taken from all of the streams, there was mercury in fish taken from all of these streams in throughout the country. And then in about one quarter to one third of the samples, the mercury levels exceeded amounts that the EPA recommends for human consumption.
And that doesn't that just make your blood boil?
It does. And
literally.
I should note that while the EPA sets a limit on the amount of mercury that humans should consume, there are many environmentalists and many doctors who recommend a level of zero consumption for mercury since it is such a potent neurotoxin. So I found that particularly disturbing that there is nowhere in the United States that is safe from mercury levels in fish. And I should also point out that the Bush administration is directly responsible for this as the leading cause of mercury contamination in the food supply is from coal-fired power plants.
Which they had zero environmental regulation over the last 8 years.
During the Bush administration. They've blocked many attempts to limit mercury levels, mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants.
All right, events.
You know, one coming up today, the Veterans for Peace is having a walkabout downtown in which they'll talk to people about how the current wars and about how veterans are being treated. Incidentally, there was a new plan by the Army this week where the way they're going to treat PTSD, they've got a great new plan for it. They're going to give all 1.1 million soldiers counseling in how to handle their emotions better. When they're on the battlefield, as though this has anything to do with PTSD whatsoever.
Never mind the physical basis for PTSD.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Veterans for Peace, walkabout, 11 o'clock today, Westlake Park.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System when it's open, et cetera, et cetera. You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And don't forget, this November, write in Satan.